much. And so, Gary, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the opportunity to have a tough room that can help move this stuff forward. My talk today is going to be on near real-time state models, a foundational technology for space automation and robotics. What I'll be talking about today, moving on to the to the chart two, which is the outline, I'll be discussing the problem as I see it, the notion of what Dexter's missing, what's involved with making it real, some of the specifics of building near real-time state models from my perspective, what's the relationship of what I'm talking about with NASA, what's its relevance to the broader scheme of things, a bit about the XISP supported missions that this relates to, some next steps, a bit of a reality check, and my conclusion. In terms of the problem, I see it as this, n-dimensional interaction problems, as in, an arbitrary number of objects interacting in an arbitrary number of ways, are part of a class of problems for which the generalized solution space is typically computationally intractable in any time frame. And as I see it, space automation and robotics present a subset of these problems that exacerbates the situation further by requiring near real-time solutions in many instances. The bottom line on this is that reality is not a convenient problem or solution space. Moving to slide four. In terms of, visually what we're talking about, you have, the world of EVA robotics. What's shown here is the combination of Dexter, the new name for this special purpose dexterous manipulator, and Canada ARM, or the SSRMS, as I helped with its development. And you also have the relationship of EVA robotics and crew working on a symbiotic basis that you have to cope with, shown on slide five. And on slide six, more specifically, as you proceed towards the notion of autonomous operations, you've got a fairly complex problem, which is represented here on slide six, rather eloquently by the vaguely anthropomorphic Dexter, with its 20 plus degrees of freedom that you have to end up coping with in a constrained environment. You also have the notion of, being able to drive, both teleoperated and semi-autonomous and autonomous vehicles that are on distant worlds that you end up having to cope with. And, the intention of this slide is to allude to the fact that this is it's not even a single data stream. You actually have a data fusion problem here that you have to cope with. And it's not just going into low Earth orbit, but how it is that we, take our and build spacecraft that go beyond, both, as robotic systems and as, crewed systems. Perhaps even, at some point running a starship. There's something suspicious up on these screens, as to exactly what's going on there. It arguably is germane to our discussion. Proceeding to slide 10, though, if this is the sort of thing that is of interest, so let's get real about it. Do you want to dance? And oddly enough, that proceeding to slide 11, there's a reason for that rather curious question. The special purpose dexterous manipulator, aka Dexter, was designed to have something called an advanced vision unit. As David Hunter, my CSA, or Canadian Space Agency's counterpart, and I envisioned it, the AVU was to provide a near real-time state model of the systems of systems that make up the SPDM, effectively an autonomic nervous system, if you will, that would, you know, give it knowledge not only of, you know, the position of all of its joints, but, the connectivity of, you know, structure of the system and the state of all of its systems and subsystems. In addition, it would have the ability to dynamically build up a world model of an assigned task area in its intersection with the environment. The combination of these two capabilities, with the appropriate sensors, cameras, tags, targets, and defined interfaces, as well as the as-built documentation of the International Space Station, was intended to support a mutable locus of control between full teleoperation and full autonomy. The bottom line on this was that the AVU was intended to allow the SPDM to effectively breakdance with an EVA astronaut rather than making paint drying seem like a spectator sport, if you will. Proceeding to slide 12. It was estimated approximate to 1995 that implementing the AVU as intended would only take about 25 times the anticipated available computational capacity of the station, as it was envisioned. Not exactly something that, ended up flying in a very risk-averse environment, and so it ended up getting deferred by our, Canadian partners. Implementing the AVU using 2016 technologies should and would be a much more straightforward proposition, given we now have multiple space qualified and or qualifiable multi-core thermally managed processors, a highly reliable, registered error correcting code ECC memory, solid state storage systems that, are, dramatically, faster and more stable, open source multi-threaded operating systems amenable to near real-time operations, multi-fault-tolerant virtualizable functions, and a generalized control architecture designed for failure tolerance. And, a brief aside here, last year I had the opportunity to go visit some of my friends and colleagues, up at McDonald Dittwilder and Associates, MDA, as it goes by these days, and go through the, SPDM labs and the rest of the robotics labs there and see all the stuff that we worked on. And, I started talking to them about, how things had evolved with respect to their control system work. And the brave soul in charge of the robotics lab there said, it was a real pain in the ass. Pain in the took is what you folks subjected us to in terms of insisting that we build a generalized control architecture as opposed to something that was specific just to the SSRMS. But we discovered something extraordinarily interesting about it. Having gone and figured out how to make a control architecture that could accommodate, multiple failure tolerance, it not only worked for the space station RMS, it worked for the SPDM, and it worked for all these other robots we're trying to build. So it turned out that that was a case of where tilting at the general problem, if you will, has resulted in something that is, amenable to many more applications than was originally anticipated, at least by the folks that had to work on it. Also, as we proceed into a pervasively networked environment with access to as-built configuration data, far more prevalent, and, relevant ISS operations and environmental data available, we have a reasonable basis to go forward. And sort of the bottom line on this is that the same logic is applicable to any EVA or IVA robotics as well as any advanced automation system that you'd anticipate going forward with. Proceeding to slide 13.
Hey, excuse me, Gary. This is Dan. Can I get in a question here?
Sure.
Yeah, help me out here. I'm just trying to remember, and I remember talking to people at MDA about this, but there was once, 20-some years ago, what they used to call a space vision system that I think was on Canadarm1, on Shuttle. I don't know if it ever got migrated to ISS, but that, you know, there were multiple cameras that gave you 3D pictures of what you're doing and stuff like that. But you're saying here it never happened? What's the deal?
Careful. The advanced vision unit never happened. Okay. What you're describing is a piece of it, which was the ability using stereoscopic cameras to do edge extraction or abstraction, and the ability to be able to provide visual augments to support teleoperation. That did happen. That was a piece of the puzzle that was developed. What the advanced vision unit was supposed to go off and do was much more than, the visual data was just one part of the data stream as part of a data fusion exercise to be able to support this mutable locus of control.
What other capabilities would you have with AVU that the space vision system didn't have then?
Well, have you ever watched the SPDM or Dexter conduct an operation?
Yeah, I've leaned over shoulders, but what?
Basically, what ends up happening is it literally makes paint drying seem like a spectator sport. Okay, it is moved in a very, very slow and deliberate manner.
Sure. In contrast
to the original models that were created, for it, which showed a much more dynamic range of motion and action that it would be capable of. Literally, what we had in mind was it, being able to, interact, with an EVA astronaut at the level that you could, euphemistically call breakdancing with it. But the reality of the situation is that you could have scripted, teleoperated, semi-autonomous and autonomous operations in partnership with EVA astronauts.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's interesting. All right. Thank you.
To the puzzle that was missing, if you will. And all right. So proceeding.
Okay. And Gary, this is Harley. This brings up a question I've been wondering about. I think Dan's question might led me to the following. I don't know the status of, and I don't know the goals for next generation or next generation NASA spacesuits. I would assume at some level they are going to themselves be highly automated. At some point they'll be highly automated and will start eventually to look a bit like robots with a human, obviously, in intimate contact with them. And I'm maybe running ahead, I did not look ahead, is the model that you're going to be describing, can that be adapted to highly advanced or automated spacesuits, that is, with a human being directly part of the system, not just remotely controlling it?
The answer is absolutely, and that's the intention. For most of my career, I've tried to argue about the value of having a software-driven level of automation and autonomy in systems.
Yeah.
But the one cautionary remark on that is the associate administrator, Phil Culbertson, once pronounced to 500-some-odd people at a big space station conclave in Williamsburg, "Gary, you have to understand, you can't change the size of an airlock in software." Okay. So the bottom line is that if you go through and you build up your work in these regards with very clearly defined hardware and software interfaces, and you have a means of structuring this knowledge, you have the ability to abstract these tools across many different automated systems.
Yeah.
And you'll see what I'm going to try and draw out here is some of the dimensions that you have to work in those regards.
Okay.
So
good.
In terms
Thank
of
you.
Making yeah. it real, on slide 13, the order of the problem to be solved must be reduced to something that's tractable. How can you do that? Well, one aspect is breaking up the problem space into many sub-problems that are suitable for parallel processing. Another is figuring out a way to focus on the sub-problems that actually matter. A classic example is, you know, the way you solve structures problems, okay? You'll find out the places where you need to, spend your time, doing more refined calculations, and the ones that aren't making a whole hell of a difference, you don't spend a lot of computational resources on. You also need to be able to use boundary conditions, initial conditions, symmetry, known geometry, established datums, and whatever, to further reduce complexity. And a very simple example of that is that there are some extraordinarily elegant, mathematics associated with coordinate transforms that you can do in robotics. But if you actually really want a robot to do something, what you want to go off and do is get it to the task area, get it to lock on to a single coordinate system that's associated with getting that task done. And that's what really matters. Okay? So what you're going off and doing is it's less about the elegance of the self and the construction of the robot, and it's much more about how it is that you actually get a task done, and the fact that the robotic or automated systems are just tools. Okay, so you have to manage the complexity and have it be just simple enough to get the job done. And the way that I think is key to do this is that what you want to do is to propagate the constraints as rapidly as possible. Moving on to slide 14, when I talk about a mutable locus of control, one of my younger associates said, "Hey, is that the name of a new rock band or something?" Okay. What I mean is that there are a number of dimensions to this. Between teleoperations and autonomous operations, between ground and in-flight operations, between scheduled and dynamic operations, between what is the defined environment and what is the sensed environment, and what is your referenced versus predicted versus sensed geometry of the task area in the environment, and really toggled and shared control. Okay, what we're talking about here is, the way things have grown up in the world of robotics is that, there's been a necessity to have both a simulation environment and an operational environment that you can toggle between. What I'm arguing for is that you want to take it to the point where it's no longer a toggle, okay? It's a shared control environment. And you have these different, in this notion of a mutable locus of control is not along a single dimension or vector. There are multiple vectors to it that you have to consider. Bottom line is that this necessitates near real-time state models of the involved systems and the environment. Proceeding to slide 15, my contention that n-dimensional interaction problems do not have to be intractable. With the appropriate metadata, transforms can be applied. In terms of the vocabulary here, I think it's useful to view data as a set of ordered symbols, data in context as information, and information in perspective as knowledge. There are a number of analogs to this. For those that aren't too far away from their intersection with mathematics is that there's a whole set of multivariable equations which are as defined aren't solvable. However, there's this mathematician called Laplace that came up with the idea that, you know, there may be a way that we could go through and transform these equations into a different space that would enable us to solve them, and then we could transform them back, the notion of a Laplace transform. By, in a very real sense, this can be extended to the world of this set of problems that we're describing with advanced automation and robotics, provided we can establish the necessary structure to go through and be able to work the problems. Arguably, then you can take the problems of interest, in a manner that can be recast and structured as items which have attributes which have values. Which, interestingly enough, if any of you folks have had an intersection with the Lisp, programming language invented by McCarthy, that one line, items which have attributes has values there, is a Lisp statement that describes an n-dimensional interaction problem in one line of code. Okay? So the intention here is, not to get totally abstract with you folks, but to point out that this is a very simple example of how you can take a complex, seemingly intractable class of problem, okay, and describe it in one line, okay? And we actually, through some work we did, I had the opportunity to do at NASA with NASA Goddard, we actually built a master engineering database system that could subsume any data set that could be recast in these terms, and it would rebuild itself in all of its venues based on the data sets which it subsumed. So there's some interesting historical precedent to this. Going forward, you could then take this material and, it can be modeled, as a set of, process flow problems, which is, again, another way of simplifying the situation. And then you layer on top of that, the notion of, inference-driven constraint propagation that can then be applied to the generalized solution space to make it computationally practical. An inference engine could be as simple as, Boolean logic. It can be a set of, if-then rules. It can be, hypothesis and test. There's all sorts of interesting mathematics with minimal set covering, theories. There's a whole bunch of things that can be leveraged. Not any one of them is perfect for any particular situation, but the combination of them give you some extraordinary tools. And another classic one, of course, is the Bayes theorem stuff, where if you've got the statistical data, you can get extraordinarily good results. So there are very interesting angles here that can be brought to bear. The bottom line that I'm trying to get across is that the structure and ordering of the knowledge makes a very real difference as to whether or not the problem is tractable or not. Going on to slide 16, in terms of building near real-time state models, you can think of the systems of systems can be bounded as a finite set of state transitions. Basically, any system that is expected to perform some number of functions arguably can be decomposed into all the states that it is intended to perform those functions in, and what identifies and characterizes those states, and you can then think of it as something that could be modeled as systems as a set of flows across defined interfaces, and a taxonomy of flows can be defined as either energy, mass, or information, and then further subdivided into individual types, What's, you know, particularly striking about this approach, though, is that each type of flow can be defined by a specific set of qualitative and quantitative attributes independent of the source and terminus. So we've taken this big, n-dimensional problem space and divided it up to a level where we can start talking about what is actually flowing across each one of these interfaces in a manner that is measurable and controllable. The bottom line on this is that each set of characterized flows can be associated with corresponding states and allowable transitions. On slide 17, it just shows, you know, this is actually something from my, you know, my thesis proposal, which the University of Maryland Aerospace Engineering Department published back in the day. It shows a, you know, subsystem of, you know, flow taxonomy, you know, in terms of mass information and area. You may come up with something more complex than this, but this is intended to get across the point that you can start structuring and ordering this information in ways that make it far more computationally tractable. Proceeding on to slide 18. Okay, what's the relationship between this and NASA? Well, the NASA Ames Research Center Mission Control Technologies Lab has something called the Mission Control Technologies Open Web Software Suite, which is a web-based modular programming environment that's being enhanced by my company, XISP Inc., to incorporate near real-time state model extensions. This work is germane to a existing Space Act agreement that NASA Ames and XISP Inc. have going forward, as well as an overarching Space Act umbrella agreement under negotiation between NASA headquarters and XISP Inc. We propose that there are some approaches to dealing with a number of, stranded pools of intellectual property, if you will, that happen to have ended up on the wrong side of the technology development valley of death, that we may be able to move forward on a public-private partnership basis with. And it stirred up some very real interest in those regards. Proceeding on to slide 19, in terms of the relevance of this, this body of work is, as we see it, an opportunity to craft viable technology demonstrations that will establish the basis for a confluence of interest between real mission users and the technology development effort. Okay, if any of you folks have been had the interesting privilege of being involved in the technology development effort, one of the most valuable things you can possibly have is real mission requirements to work to. Okay. I think that this can lead to a range of technology development missions on both the International Space Station and subsequent flight opportunities that can make efficient and effective use of the near real-time state models and the enhanced OpenMCT web software suite. Not that, any of this stuff, is necessarily the best thing since sliced bread, but there are real things that you can do with it for each increment of resources that you put into it. In terms of, what we're, the XISP Inc. supported missions that we're looking to for mission requirements, we have, Team Alpha CubeSat, part of the NASA CubeQuest Challenge, which is a, the operations of a 6U CubeSat that's set to launch up to space station as commercial cargo, be deployed from there along with a trajectory insertion bus to take it to a deep space trajectory insertion point, and then using alternate low and minimum energy trajectories, go out past 4 million kilometers, conduct a series of communications tests, and then cycle back, passing next to L2 and end up in a resonant orbit around the moon, and conduct a series of tests there. That is, one piece of the puzzle. We also have a space-to-space power beaming mission, which is looking at the effective use of radiant energy beam components, again, based on the International Space Station initially, to power a set of co-orbiting free-flying CubeSat spacecraft, 6U CubeSats, as part of a radiant energy test bed, and then hopefully extending that to repurposing logistics carriers as co-orbiting crew-tended free flyers for some number of cycles. We also have an interoperable network communications architecture mission, which is looking at testing delay and disturbance-tolerant networking with real-world requirements in creating a pervasively networked DTN gateway for station that implements quality of service-based routing. One of the interesting pieces of this puzzle is that the same foundational technology supports all of these missions. And, of course, we have adopted the name Advanced Vision and Task Area Recognition, AVATAR, which our goal is to support a mutable locus of control between teleoperation and autonomy on a shared control basis. Going on to slide 21, what we're doing more specifically with each of these missions is first defining and prototyping parametric state models for the integrated end-to-end mission operations control applications, implementing the parametric state models for both as technology development and demonstration mission prototypes, then for test purposes, and then for the flight articles themselves. So this isn't something that just comes in at the end that you patch on. You actually start considering how to implement this from the start, with the design of your spacecraft or systems. And then, the notion is that this effort includes the incremental, iterative, and a recursive development of near real-time state models of all the supported mission components operating within the MCT framework and environment that Ames has provided. The MOCA progress for each of these supported missions is driven by both the mission status and the schedule of each mission and the availability of resources. Going on to slide 23, the MOCA extended activities will focus on on-orbit demonstrations and testing the efficacy of the near-real-time parametric state models developed for the supported missions, and the follow-on activities will focus on assessing, reviewing, and establishing the near-real-time parametric state model tools to other current and future technology development missions. Basically, the bottom line with all this stuff is you've got to find a way that is not only an interesting research project, but it's doing something of demonstrable value for some number of missions. To give you an example of sort of where we are, we mocked up a set of screens for the Alpha CubeSat spacecraft, and you folks all may be familiar with the notion of looking at a spacecraft operator screen that's got it's split up between the incoming telemetry and what are the queued up command sequences and the intended schedule of the spacecraft. Well, we wanted to be able to take and, as a data fusion exercise, create a view that effectively conveys the state of the spacecraft in a manner that is both useful to the operator and useful to any semi-automated and automated control system. And it starts off with the notion of, okay, you've got a spacecraft. Okay, it has some number of systems and subsystems that have definable status and some number of payloads. Proceeding to slide 25, You can drill down to, in this particular case, this is a comparatively simple block diagram of the electrical power system for Alpha CubeSat. Where this gets interesting is that between each of these blocks, there's a definable interface. Each of those defined interfaces has some number of flows that go across those interfaces, okay? Some of which matter more than others. The net result of those flows may or may not be mission critical. It may have, feedback or implications across multiple other subsystems. We have a way of going through and structuring and ordering that. That information and turning it into operative knowledge both for operator and semi-autonomous and autonomous systems. My apologies that, this is a bit of an eye chart, but the intention really is to demonstrate that there's a logic of being able to drill down to successive levels here. And what I've shown on slide 26 is an analogous diagram with respect to the communication systems. Same arguments apply. With each system and subsystem, there are different nuances, different things that are unique about that the role that that system or subsystem plays in a system or supporting a particular function, and we need to you need to be able to capture and structure that knowledge. 27. It does the same thing for, the propulsion system where it has something that is unique here that's worth pointing out. One of the key things with respect to propulsion systems is where are the safety inhibits? Okay. And what is their status? What are their interfaces? Okay, by going through and following this approach of, structuring the knowledge appropriately, you not only have what amounts to being, the assessments that's done from a safety review perspective, you have the same rules applied on an ongoing basis for the operation of your system, which can be, very, very, very useful. Taking basically analysis and review from being an offline process to making it a part of the how the control system is intended to function. Proceeding on to slide 28, the point of this is that we took for Alpha CubeSat and created what amounts to being a state and a state transition model that took it down to a very reduced number of discrete states that the spacecraft could exist in, and a way of going through on a deterministic basis, arriving at a known state based on any of the anticipated conditions, short of something blowing the thing up, the point is that you may not be able to eliminate all of the complexity, but you want just enough complexity, okay, in order to be able to accommodate the actual functions that are required. And if you can go through and create the ability of the system to recursively leverage the state transition logic, it becomes an even more straightforward process. Proceeding to slide 29, in terms of next steps, the Missions Operations Control Applications, or MOCA mission, is now a commercial mission recognized by NASA. There'll be work through with NASA through a combination of established and proposed SpaceX agreements, as noted before. MOCA is intended to be a foundation for moving forward with the Avatar mission. We're looking for additional partners and participants They're being sought in both commercial, academic, nonprofit, and government sectors, not just NASA, but with several of our missions, we're looking to, we've been trying to cooperatively work with the Naval Research Laboratory and other other government agencies that are have an interest in such things, and also the use of ISS helps ensure that this is an international cooperative and or collaborative research effort. The bottom line is proceeding under Space Act Agreement authority here requires us to deal with this as a public-private partnership where we're drawing in as many NASA centers as we can, as many other participants that are willing to come together and are interested in helping to make something real here that would not necessarily otherwise be or necessarily would happen as quickly. An important aspect of this, particularly as it relates to both the academic world and the world, the commercial world, where you actually have to get funding for things on a much more constrained environment, is that we can construct missions where for every increment of resources that you put into it, you can get something of demonstrable value out that someone or some entity is willing to pay for and actually use. In terms of a reality check, we do need to reduce the number of perceived impossible things that have to be accepted before breakfast in these regards. Hats off to Lewis Carroll for a good line here. In order to do that, we've got, this is a way of incrementally, as I put it barely in English, of disabusing people of unfounded notions. Doing something real with the technology that's of demonstrable value can help establish the confluence of interests necessary to mature the technology for more advanced applications. And least anyone, be confused about it. You can view the little icon in the lower left-hand corner as both a cautionary tale, not necessarily so much about what you, in view robotics and automated systems to do, but human beings really have to pay attention to what it is that they program a system to do. Okay? It turned out, as it worked out, how that was Hal's problem. As it was worked out with our, as Arthur C. Clarke saw it. In terms of a conclusion, as I alluded to, an incremental investment in the development of near real-time state modeling capabilities that meet real mission requirements, I think can serve as a foundational technology for evolving space automation and robotics capabilities. This work can help deliver reduced cost, schedule, and technical risk, mission-enhancing technology, and in some cases, mission-enabling technology. I really appreciate the opportunity to present this, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions I can. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Gary. And folks, we do have some time for questions, and I wonder if anybody has questions for him. There is a bit of time left. Quite a wide-ranging presentation, folks.
It is an interesting aspect of this is that there is a there's different pieces of work, as I alluded to earlier. This draws on work that I had done in support of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center as part of an RTOP activity for advanced Earth orbiting spacecraft, and it led on to work that I was doing with the Canadian Space Agency, part of the space station requirements, and the notion that this you know, when you look at the range of missions that you know, we're talking about here, the idea that you can have a technology that can be of you know, potentially instrumental value across that sort of range of missions, you know, I think you know, represents an extraordinary opportunity.
Indeed, actually, Gary, one of the students, I got an email from one of our summer interns, the folks that I mentioned were sitting down the hall here at Goddard in their meeting, and she, I think she asked, is with the NASA now funding, she thinks it's three, I think there are four, concept studies for post-space station, cislunar, long-duration habitation systems for the next decade. Have you been approached by or are you approaching them to discuss with them this capability for the robotic systems that they are supposed to be including on their habitation, as part of their habitation system?
I have not had the opportunity to contribute to that yet. I'd love to have some point of contacts there. I have been talking to folks like Katie Coleman in the Office of Chief Technologist's office. You know, she found it rather striking last year at the Space Station R&D conference. She was giving a presentation on what it was like to, teleoperate the robotic systems. And, we ended up in an extended conversation afterwards. She, started looking at me funny and saying, hold on a second, you're not an astronaut. Okay. I haven't seen you before. How do you know that?
No.
Okay, what's going on here? And, so it turned out that, it was something that, definitely caught her attention. We've got, and I've, been reaching out, to a number of different labs, both the University of Maryland Space Systems Lab, Dave Aitken and Company, the folks at the MIT Space Systems Lab, Alvar and Company, talking to David Miller, of course, at OCT, and we're working with the Human Exploration and Operations Missions Director Jason Cruzon's group, and with Jim Shearer and Company in the Space Communications and Navigation Office.
Have you been speaking to our folks here at Goddard, our robotic
Cepelina's group? I would very much love the opportunity to do so in some detail. I have, get this stuff rolling forward in a contemporary context. Has been challenging from a resource standpoint. But what I wanted to do before I got to Goddard was to be able to bring something to the table, and I can do that now.
Excellent. Well, for what it's worth, I mean, you know how to reach these guys. I will send to CEPI and Company the link to your presentation.
I would very much appreciate that. And again, with this stuff, I don't think anyone can make any claim to immaculate perception on it. But with people working together and being able to address this stuff from different perspectives and finding a common ground of vocabulary, I think there's some real things that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Good. Do folks have any other input, comments, questions, such like that, while we have Gary online? All right, we're coming right up. Excellent. Thank you again. And apparently, Gary, you answered a bunch of questions. If you need any assistance in contacting CEPI's folks here at Goddard, let me know. And you seem to have intrigued a bunch of our interns here at Goddard, so thank you very much.
Well, wonderful. Thanks again for the opportunity.